the Queen and the royal family.
Part 2.
The UK has both historically and contemporaneously prided itself on its tradition of open wills, whereby wills are open to inspection by the public, mostly out of concern to prevent theft and abuse of authority. And yet the royal family has dissented from this long-established national practice by their ability, since 1910, to seal their wills. The untimely death in 1910 of errant Prince Francis, the brother-in-law of King George V, set in stone a tradition which the British royal family jealously guards to this day, the concept and practice of sealed wills. The catalyst for the un-British practice of sealed wills was Prince Francis' erratic, if not reckless, lifestyle, best exemplified by his compulsive gambling and extreme womanizing. In his will, Francis is believed to have left priceless family jewels to one of his more flamboyant mistresses, Ellen Constance, the Countess of Kilmery, with whom he was rumoured to have had an illegitimate child. This significant act of indiscretion and breach of protocol spurred the royal family into action, first by suppressing the will and subsequently reaching out to Ellen Constance with a hefty bribe, £10,000 to be exact, which amounts to £700,000 in today's money. For the past 100 years or so, English courts have upheld the monarchy's demand that wills of its members, in stark contrast to the wills of the general public, should be sealed and, in effect, kept secret in perpetuity. On the few occasions when this self-declared right to secrecy has been challenged in the courts, notably in 2006 by one Robert Brown, who claims he is an illegitimate child of the deceased Princess Margaret, this has been quashed by the Queen's judges. The precedent set by the suppression of the will of Prince Francis, above all, demonstrates that the British legal system, rooted firmly in the principles of English law, never flinches when it comes to accommodating the whims and fancies of the monarchy. This was in evidence, most recently, in the aftermath of the demise of Elizabeth Angela Marguerite Bowes Loyne, also known as the Queen Mother, who died in March 2002.
A mother, a mum, the Queen Mum.
In keeping with royal tradition, established in 1910 in the wake of Prince Francis's demise, the Queen Mother's will was sealed up on the orders of the High Court, which means that on present trajectory, in view of the total hegemony of the monarchy, it is closed to inspection and publication in perpetuity. The blanket secrecy surrounding royal wills is central to the secrecy in which they conduct all their personal affairs. From wealth accumulation to the conduct of sordid affairs and other scandalous relationships, the case of Diana's husband, Prince Charles, speaks volumes. Diana's husband and her heir to the throne, who is no stranger to sordid and secret affairs. Charles's most infamous escapades was with his childhood sweetheart, Camilla Parker Bowles, with whom he started a secret affair in 1986, 5 years after his marriage with Diana. This is the same Prince Charles whose love for hunting animals is equal to, if not excessive of, his love for human flesh. An avid fox hunter, Charles once famously said he would not stop hunting foxes in the British countryside until the practice was made illegal. Fox hunting was made illegal in the UK in November 2004, and while it is not known if Prince Charles partakes in these illegal hunts, it is well known that for years he lobbied former Prime Minister Tony Blair to repeal the ban. By all credible accounts, Charles's brother Andrew is more morally compromised, as evidenced by his long-standing relationship with the deceased American paedophile Jeffrey Epstein. Prince Andrew, or the Duke of York to use his formal title, is the quintessential royal playboy, as demonstrated by his long list of romantic entanglements, even after his ill-fated marriage to Sarah Ferguson in 1986. Beginning in 1980, the Duke of York has conducted affairs with an astonishing number of glamorous women, including the former Playboy model Courtney Love, reality TV star Caroline Stanbury, and the American photographer and actress Koo Stark. Andrew's wife of 10 years, the notoriously volatile Sarah Ferguson, was also no stranger to scandal and sordid affairs. Her immoral and carefree lifestyle exploded onto the public domain after photos of her lounging by the pool with her financial advisor, the Texan millionaire John Bryan, kissing and sucking her toes were published. However, what the British public sees in the way of royal scandals, which erupt onto the public sphere from time to time, is merely the tip of the proverbial iceberg. Plenty of dodgy dealings take place behind the scenes, which the public never hears about, as the monarchy's ironclad secrecy, enforced by the courts and broader machinery of state, shows no sign of relenting. The British monarchy exerts influence from behind the scenes in a carefully choreographed effort to present the British system as a parliamentary democracy with minimal interference in the nation's day-to-day affairs by the Queen. But like everything else in modern Britain, appearances can be deceptive. Even the most intrinsic feature of modern government, namely legislation. On the surface, the process of legislation in the UK is undertaken by both the Houses of Parliament and the government of the day, playing a central role in introducing proposed legislation in the form of bills. But the monarch plays an influential role both at the beginning and end of the legislative process through the Queen's consent and assent. With the former signifying the sovereign's agreement with parliamentary debate on a proposed piece of legislation, and the latter marking the sovereign's seal of approval to a bill that has successfully completed the parliamentary process.
Very grateful, and I think my views on this are pretty well understood.
Indeed, a bill only becomes an act or law of the land once it has been granted royal assent by the Queen. It might be argued that none of this dissents in a fundamental way from the principles of constitutional monarchy insofar as the sovereign is expected to play a symbolic role in the legislative process. But nothing could be further from the truth. As the Queen actively employs her power of withholding consent for proposed legislation, often in concert with and the active collusion of a sitting government. This often occurs when a sitting government wants to stop proposed legislation which originates from the inner circles of policymaking. Therefore, briefing the Queen and persuading her to withhold her consent from the bill, to be even discussed in Parliament, is the most effective way of stopping inconvenient proposed legislation in its tracks. In keeping with the British tradition of secrecy, records are not kept as to how many times the Queen has exercised her power to withhold consent from proposed legislation entering the parliamentary fray.
In the House of Peers.
But the public know of at least three occasions. The Titles Bill, 1964. The Rhodesia Independence Bill, 1969. And the Military Action Against Iraq Bill, 1999. On all three occasions, the bills were proposed by backbenchers in the House of Commons, and on all three occasions, the sitting government quashed the initiatives by way of persuading the Queen to intervene.
Her attack on the BBC.
In fact, whereas the UK is continually at pains to project itself as the world's leading parliamentary democracy, with Parliament supposedly acting as the will of the people, the truth is that an unelected sovereign plays a central role in the legislative process, both in passive and active capacities. In February 2021, The Guardian revealed that more than 1,000 laws have been vetted by the Queen or Prince Charles through a secretive procedure before they were approved by the UK's elected members of Parliament. The huge number of laws subject to royal vetting cover matters ranging from justice, social security, pensions, race relations, and food policy, through to obscure rules on car parking charges and hovercraft. The wealth of the royal family in terms of fixed assets is concentrated in two crown bodies, the Duchy of Lancaster and Duchy of Cornwall. The Duchy of Lancaster is by far the most consequential, as it constitutes the private estate of the sovereign Queen Elizabeth II. The Duchy of Cornwall, meanwhile, belongs to the eldest son of the reigning monarch, which currently is Prince Charles. These holdings, or crown bodies, to use British political jargon, merely represents the vast estates, including palaces, that belong to the royal family and which the state upkeeps with taxpayers' money. But the Queen's wealth, as well as other leading members of the royal family, exceeds the value of the buildings and lands held by the two duchies. As far back as 2001, the Mail on Sunday calculated that the Queen was worth £1.15 billion, with her vast investment portfolio worth £500 million alone. The Queen reportedly is an avid collector of expensive and exotic items. Her collection alone was worth an eye-watering £100 million. But as faithful as he was to the pertinent facts, Hall's description was, by all credible accounts, an underestimate. In 2017, the Paradise Paper leak revealed that millions of pounds from the private estate of Britain's Queen Elizabeth II had been invested in offshore tax haven funds. The royal family doesn't have to pay a single penny for the upkeep of the vast estates under their control. And needless to say, members of the royal household don't pay a single penny in income tax either, or any other form of tax for that matter. And that's just the beginning, as the royal family receives a more than generous stipend from the state to maintain their lavish lifestyles, all at the expense of the out-of-pocket British taxpayer. The current legislative framework for funding the lifestyle and expenses of the royal family is embodied in the Sovereign Grant Act 2011, which replaced the civil list mechanism established by King George III in 1760. On the face of it, the new arrangement is advantageous to the monarchy, as income from the old civil list in the years 2001 to 2011 was fixed at £7.9 million annually. By contrast, in 2012, the new sovereign grant scheme funneled an exorbitant £1 million into the pockets of the royal household. In the year 2018 to 2019, this had increased to a staggering £82.8 million, and by all accounts, it is set to rise by at least 8 to 10% annually for the foreseeable future. To place financial arrangements on a more favourable footing, the royals could always rely on the Tory party, which had for the past 180 years, since its foundation in the 1830s, championed the cause of monarchy as part of its broader right-wing political and ideological agenda.
If Parliament were a school.
When the Conservative Party came to power following the May 2010 general election, albeit as part of a coalition government with the Liberal Democrats, they quickly set about abolishing the civil list arrangement of 1760. The then Tory Chancellor, George Osborne, contrived a scheme, doubtless in close consultation with the Queen and her son Prince Charles, which would replace the 1760 deal with a new arrangement whereby a percentage of the profits of the Crown estate would be diverted to royal accounts. This was initially set at 15% of profits annually, but has subsequently been increased to 25% to cover a bells and whistles upgrade to Buckingham Palace. Osborne and the Tories went the extra mile to please the Queen and her eldest son. For, as part of the new deal, if income from the Crown estates fell 1 year, the royals would be compensated for the loss. And vice versa, in the event of above-inflation income stream, the royals get to pocket the excess. The arrangement of 2011 has all the trappings of placing the royal family above the vicissitudes of the British economy. Despite its massive constitutional significance and considerable financial implications, information about this new arrangement was kept to a small circle within the government. It was rushed through a small committee in the House of Commons, with only the Scottish National Party objecting to its terms.
This is almost the kind of behaviour we would expect to see in the Duma in Moscow.
To make matters worse, the draft legislation was personally delivered to Prince Charles by the pliant Tory Chancellor Osborne so that the Queen's eldest son could issue his consent to the proposed legislation. Britain is not an anomaly in Europe in terms of having a monarchy. Excluding the UK, there are 9 monarchies left in Europe. But what sets the European monarchies apart from Britain's royal family is their genuine and robust constitutional status, in addition to multiple layers of oversight exercised over them to prevent abuse of power and privilege. For example, under Article 19 of the Norwegian Constitution, in order for the king to accede to the throne, he has to make the following pledge: I promise and swear that I will govern the Kingdom of Norway in accordance with the Constitution. Similarly, Article 32 of the Dutch Constitution requires that the king shall swear or promise allegiance to the Constitution and that he will faithfully discharge his duties. The remaining monarchies in Europe are truly constitutional, insofar as they are subordinate to the policies which they purport to represent. By stark contrast, the British monarchy stands not only above democracy, but above the law itself. Indeed, they like to think they are the law, inasmuch as they do whatever they please, including accumulating wealth without paying a penny in tax. Seen in this context, the British royal family constitutes Europe's largest imperial monarchy, apparently impervious to the vicissitudes of politics and history. It doesn't stop there, as even their upkeep far exceeds that of their European counterparts. The decadence and greed of the British monarchy puts European monarchies, indeed monarchies across the world, to shame. As for palaces, for example, the Spanish, Dutch and Danish royal families each have access to only 2 palaces. The House of Windsor, meanwhile, occupies 15 state residences, and that figure excludes privately owned estates like Balmoral Castle and Sandringham House. Monarchies around the world are adapting fast to political developments, if only to ensure their survival in an age of forensic scrutiny. Japan, which credibly claims to be the oldest monarchy in the world, is leading the way by trying to create as much distance as possible between the royal family and public expenditure. Prince Akashino, who is next in line to succeed Emperor Naruhito, announced that the royal family should cover the expense of succession ceremony from its own funds, as opposed to relying on the state treasury to cover the costs. This is a world away from the dreamscape occupied by Queen Elizabeth II, her heirs and entourage. Despite their vast wealth, the royals make liberal use of public resources for their own pleasure and comfort. For instance, Prince William, who many believe will be the next king as Charles may abdicate in favor of his oldest son, once used a military helicopter to fly to a stag party. By the same token, the royals are not shy of using fabulously wealthy people's private resources either. In 2018, the American actor and producer George Clooney treated Prince Harry and his wife Meghan Markle to a decadent holiday in Italy. Clooney reportedly flew the royal couple there in his private jet and gave them unfettered access to his luxurious 25-room villa. The question is, what, if anything, Clooney got in return for his extraordinary generosity? When the scandal about the couple's pension for private jets first broke out, some observers were puzzled as to why the singer and songwriter Elton John had been so keen to leap to Harry and Meghan's defense. The answer may lie in the fact that the royal family uses its wealth and privilege to cultivate famous and influential types, exactly for such occasions when it needs to polish up its public image. Modern Britain is a country of contrasts, not to mention deep contradictions. The dizzyingly complex mix of traditions, mores, and an apparently insatiable postmodern impulse has created a country that is hard to decipher, let alone fully understand. And so it is with the monarchy. On the surface, most Britons appear to support the antiquated institution, not just on the grounds of sentimentalism, but also good old-fashioned British pragmatism. And yet, the UK is home to a small but vocal Republican community.
I'm here to protest the unaccountable power of the Crown, what it symbolises, which is hereditary privilege, and the constitutional power that it still has.
We don't need that kind of icon. No, much better icons are, you know, things like ideas like democracy and the equality of citizenship, and maybe someone chosen by us to represent us.
The fact of the matter is, there is no credible evidence or indication even that the British public wants to abolish the monarchy, except for very cosmetic changes to the monarchy and only to placate public anger, never to reform the monarchy itself. Based on this clear political reality, the British monarchy is set to survive the 21st century, perhaps with little, if any, substantial change. But a parallel development points to the diminution of the UK's role in the world, perhaps even the breakup of the UK itself, as evidenced by the strengthening independence movement in Scotland and, to a lesser extent, Wales. As Britain becomes more parochial, the rest of the world is likely to care much less about the House of Windsor, and that may be a punishment worse than death for Britain's media-conscious royal family.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio programme.
The limelight.
European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen has warned of strongest possible response to attacks on European energy infrastructure following what appears to be explosions targeting the Nord Stream pipelines in the Baltic Sea. Please stay with us for more. Britain's Guardian newspaper has more on this story. Sabotage is the most likely cause of leaks in two Baltic Sea gas pipelines between Russia and Europe, European leaders have said, after seismologists reported explosions around the Nord Stream pipelines. A seismograph on the Danish island of Bornholm, near where the leaks occurred, twice recorded spikes on Monday, 26th of September. The day on which the Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2 gas pipelines underwent dramatic falls in pressure, the German Geological Research Centre, GFZ, has said. A Danish military flight over the leaks brought back striking images from the ruptures, including one showing an area of bubbling gas a kilometre wide on the sea's surface. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said the leaks were due to sabotage, and threatened the strongest possible response to any deliberate disruption of European energy infrastructure. Any deliberate disruption of active European energy infrastructure is unacceptable and will lead to the strongest possible response, she warned, and urged an investigation to get full clarity on the events and why. Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen described them as deliberate acts, adding, "We're not talking about an accident." US Secretary of State Antony Blinken has spoken to Danish Foreign Minister Jeppe Kofod about the apparent sabotage, said US State Department spokesman Ned Price late on Tuesday. Sweden's outgoing Prime Minister Magdalena Andersson said, "There have been detonations, although," Sweden's Foreign Minister Ann Lind said they would not speculate on motives or actors. The seismograph recorded near silence until just after midnight GMT or 2 a.m. local time, when there was a spike representing a tremor in the earth, followed by a continuous hissing waveform. The pattern was repeated about 5 p.m. GMT. The German Geological Research Centre, GFZ, declined to be drawn on whether the tremors recorded could have been the result of an explosion, but scientists at the research centre ruled out the possibility that the leaks could have been caused by earthquakes. There was a spike and then regular noise, a GFZ spokesperson, Josef Zenz, said. "We cannot say if that could be gas streaming out." A seismologist quoted by Swedish television suggested the activity may have been the result of explosions. Björn Lund, director of the Swedish National Seismic Network, which measures Swedish earthquakes and explosions, told Sweden's SVT national television channel that the event, one of which registered a magnitude of 2.3, may have been caused by undersea detonations. "You can see clearly how the waves bounce from the bottom to the surface. There is no doubt that it was a blast. We even had a station in Nosio that picked this up," said Bjorn Lund, who also lectures in seismology at Uppsala University in Sweden. Meanwhile, Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov called the news very concerning and said, "No option can be ruled out right now, including sabotage." "This is very concerning news," Dmitry Peskov said, calling for a prompt investigation. "Indeed, we're talking about some damage of an unclear nature to the pipeline in Denmark's economic zone." British sources said they believe it may not be possible to determine what occurred with certainty. One British expert speculated that any explosions were unlikely to have been caused by a submarine or underwater vehicle, because their presence would have been detected in the relatively shallow Baltic Sea waters. Sections of the Nord Stream pipelines are between 80 metres and 110 metres deep. An alternative scenario could be that mines were dropped from a disguised commercial vessel days or even weeks ahead of the attack, then remotely detonated to cause the explosions. But the latter scenario is entirely hypothetical and speculative. The day of drama began when Danish Energy Agency said it had found the leaks on the Nord Stream 1 pipeline northeast of the island of Bornholm, and a third leak in the Nord Stream 2 pipeline in Swedish waters southeast of the island of Bornholm. "This is not a small crack, it's a really big hole," the Danish Energy Agency said. NBC News tells us more about this story. Sabotage was behind underwater explosions that sent gas spewing from two major pipelines connecting Europe and Russia, Western leaders concurred on Wednesday, 28th of September. The European Union's top diplomat said the leaks from the Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2 pipelines under the Baltic Sea were caused by a deliberate act, though he stopped short of directly accusing anyone. It remained unclear who or what might be behind the leaks, with the Kremlin dismissing suggestions it was to blame as predictable and also predictably stupid. US Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Tuesday that if the apparent sabotage is confirmed, it would be in no one's interest, adding that the leaks on the pipelines, which run from Russia to Europe, will not have a significant impact on Europe's energy resilience. But while neither pipeline had been delivering natural gas to Europe, the continent's standoff with Russia and its looming winter energy crisis meant alarm bells were ringing all over Europe. "All available information indicates those leaks are the result of a deliberate act," the European Union foreign policy chief Josep Borrell said in a statement on behalf of the European bloc's 27 member states. "Any deliberate disruption of European energy infrastructure is utterly unacceptable and will be met with a robust and united response." The Swedish Public Prosecutor's Office said it had opened an investigation into the explosions. Seismologists in Denmark and Sweden said they had registered two powerful blasts on Monday, 26th of September, in the vicinity of the leaks, which were spotted off the Danish Baltic island of Bornholm. European officials, including Swedish Prime Minister, have said the pattern of damage to the pipelines is highly suggestive of an explosion. On Wednesday, Russian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Maria Zakharova referred to a statement made by US President Joe Biden back in February of this year, in which Biden said, "We will bring an end to Nord Stream 2, Maria Zakharova said Joe Biden must give a definitive answer about whether the United States followed through on what she characterized as a threat, adding, "Russia intends to convene a United Nations Security Council meeting focused on the Nord Stream pipeline leaks." A US official called Russia's insinuation that Joe Biden's administration is behind the explosion as preposterous, denying it had played any role in the unexplained attack.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The Israeli regime's ambassador to Morocco was recently entangled in sexual harassment and corruption at the regime's mission in Rabat. Now, the scandal comes nearly 2 years after the North African country normalize its ties with Tel Aviv. Now, this gross misconduct angered the people of Morocco, leading to demonstrations, and eventually Israel was forced to sack its errant envoy. Even before the latest scandal, Moroccans have been holding regular protests against the normalization of ties with the Israeli regime. Here is one such protest. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. In the first part of our program today, we are focusing on the sexual abuse of Moroccan women by the Israeli regime's envoy in the country. Following this latest scandal, the people in Morocco held rallies rejecting ties between their country and the Israeli regime. The second part of our program will be on the recent general elections in Kenya that have been touted as a success story in a continent that has seen a wave of military takeovers and political turmoil. Stay with us as our experts give us their incisive analysis on today's subjects and be part of our conversation by sending your comments through our social media handle.
Moroccans protest misconduct by Israeli envoy. The people of Morocco have rallied against ties between their country and the Israeli regime, condemning David Govrin, the regime's envoy in Rabat, for the sexual abuse of Moroccan women. Irate Moroccans marched outside parliament in the capital Rabat against the North African country's normalization of relations with the Israeli regime after Tel Aviv. Following the protests, Israel had no option but to sack its ambassador amid an investigation over the sex abuse scandal.
The masses in Morocco have been resolute in opposing the normalization of ties with the Israeli regime. Now, the regime in Morocco uses brutal force to clamp down on anti-normalization protests, but the masses have not relented in resisting ties with the Israeli regime. Well, to discuss the latest scandal at the Israeli regime's embassy in Morocco, we have contacted Khalid Berekat, a journalist and activist. Thanks a lot for joining us today, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Now, our first question, what is your take on the sex scandal involving the Israeli regime's envoy in Rabat, which of course is not surprising coming from an Israeli?
Well, this scandal is just one of many scandals, actually. The scandals we hear about is the one that is exposed by either the press or, you know, Moroccan political and social forces in Morocco. The problem is that this is business as usual between the Morocco regime and the Israeli regime. There has been many, many scandals and bigger one, in fact, crimes, and it was joint crimes between the Moroccan regime and the Israeli regime. This is a reflection of popular position in Morocco, who does not want any kind of relationship with Israel. These scandals are carried by the Israeli ambassadors and officials, especially on the sexual harassment, the corruption is also part of Israel infiltrating Arab societies through normalization.
Govrin is facing allegations of exploiting several Moroccan women, sexual harassment, and indecent exposure. There were also complaints of sexual harassment within the mission. Demonstrators who burned an Israeli flag at their protest rally denounced both 59-year-old Govrin and Moroccan Foreign Minister Nasser Bourita. The Israeli regime's envoy clearly does not respect or care about the dignity of the people of Morocco, and especially women, in this Muslim nation. The acts by the envoy further reveal the immoral and evil nature of officials of the Israeli regime.
Well, they don't care about the dignity of the woman in Morocco, but they also don't even care about Moroccan Jews who are in Palestine. Israel, the Israeli regime is a racist regime built on Western hegemony, and we see what they do to Moroccans, whether they're Palestinian from Moroccan roots in Jerusalem, and the way they treat Palestinians who comes from Morocco historically, and also the way they degrade even Moroccan Jews inside, quote-unquote Israel. So this is not new. And so to be in Morocco and to have these policies and these practices against the Moroccan woman is just part of the Israeli nature regime.
The sex scandal involving the Israeli regime's envoy in Morocco was expected to ignite a serious diplomatic dispute between Rabat and Tel Aviv. However, the monarchy in Morocco has treated the serious matter casually, and this has further angered Moroccans. Now, why has the monarchy in Morocco failed to take stern action against the Israeli regime's envoy, yet he brazenly disrespected the dignity, beliefs, and the culture of Moroccans?
See, we have to understand the relationship between the regime in Morocco and the Zionist regime. This is a relationship that goes back to the 50s. Morocco has always depended on Israel to even assassinate some of the oppositions of the king. For example, the known leader Mehdi Nebrika, who was assassinated in France in October 29, 1965, at the hands of the both Israelis and Moroccan intelligence. Many operations has been carried by both regimes. The Morocco regime have a very strong relationship with Israel since the 60s, but it was always hidden. Now, in 2006 and 2007, there were so many records released exposing the Moroccan regime relationship with the Zionist regime. And this is a relationship that is under the wing of the United States. These are allies of the United States.
The Israeli regime and Morocco agreed on December 10, 2020, to normalize relations in a deal brokered with the help of the administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump, making the North African country the fourth Arab state to recently normalize with the regime. The others were the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Sudan. The people of Morocco have always supported the liberation of Palestinian territories occupied by the Israeli regime, and have therefore categorically rejected normalization of ties with the Israeli regime.
Normalization of ties with the Israeli regime has not only humiliated the people of Morocco, but has also failed to bring any tangible economic benefits, and the people have been holding protests over rising prices. Now, the normalization deal has worsened the economic situation in Morocco, and the people are not happy. Why is the monarchy in Morocco adamant about maintaining ties with the Israeli regime?
Because the regime and the ruling class of Morocco believe that the only way to sustain the regime and to keep it alive is by strengthening their relationship with the United States and with Israel and with other Arab reactionary regimes. And so it's a part of a camp that depends solely on this relationship. I mean, the crimes that the regime have committed against the people of Morocco and the people of Western Sahara, the crimes of the regime against the revolution in Algeria, you know, by conspiring against the leadership of the revolution in Algeria, the atrocities that the regime has participated in so many different places in the Arab world. So this is just not a regime that plays a role in Morocco, it also has its dirty hands all over the place. And people in Morocco actually know that this regime is there by force and by the help and the assistance of foreign power, particularly the United States and Israel and the Gulf.
Well, there you have it. The ruling monarchy in Morocco is being sustained by foreign powers, especially the United States and the Israeli entity, against the will of the masses. I would like to thank our guest, Khalid Barakat, a journalist and activist, for his incisive analysis today. We'll now take a short break before our next segment of our show, which is on the recent general elections in Kenya. Stay with us.
Kenya's elections setting trends for Africa.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
William Ruto was sworn in as Kenya's fifth president on Tuesday, 30 September, a week after the country's Supreme Court rejected a challenge by his opponent in a close-fought election. Ruto received 50.5% of the vote against 48.8% for Raila Odinga.
Ruto was President Uhuru Kenyatta's vice president, but the two fell out and Kenyatta backed opposition leader Raila Odinga in the vote. Ruto, the son of a peasant, won by portraying himself as an underdog hustler, battling political dynasties and the elite in this East African nation.
He was sworn in as Kenya's fifth president in Nairobi at a 60,000-seat stadium that was filled before dawn. The ceremony was also attended by regional leaders and representatives from across the world. For more on the recent peaceful transition of power in Kenya after closely contested general elections, we have contacted Julius Mbaluto, a journalist and an African affairs analyst. Thanks a lot for your time today. Now, the recent elections in Kenya have been described as an example of a successful democratic experience in the region and the wider African continent. Now, do you agree with this viewpoint?
I definitely agree to that kind of observation. Definitely. Kenyans went to vote, and it was a peaceful electoral process. And then, of course, you have the outcome of the election, announcement of president-elect. All that was peacefully done. And, of course, although results were not pleasant to everybody, half the country were like, our candidate has lost, the other one was, our candidate has won. That didn't bring any problems, no fighting, nothing.
International election observers commended the people of Kenya and the Electoral Commission for conducting free, fair, and credible elections. Former Tanzania President Jakaya Kikwete, who led the East African Community EAC Observer Mission, told a press briefing in Nairobi that he was satisfied with the process.
It's African Community Election Observation Mission is satisfied that the way the 2022 general election, Kenyan general election, was conducted on polling day, the people of Kenya were given the opportunity to elect leaders of their choice freely.
The electoral process in Kenya was closely monitored across Africa as it set a new and higher electoral bar for the country and the rest of the continent. South Africa's Minister of International Relations, Dr. Naledi Pandor, commended the aggrieved parties in Kenya for going the legal route to challenge the results.
As long as you have an independent electoral authority that conducts itself in terms of the law, you should have successful processes. And should there be any concern by parties that things didn't go the right way, there must be a legal route to follow. And that's what's happening in Kenya.
Kenya previously had incidents of deadly violence after elections. But this year, the post-election period was peaceful, even after the Supreme Court upheld Ruto's victory. Analysts say this indicates that Kenyan democracy has finally come of age.
Kenyans kept telling their presidential candidates, whatever the Supreme Court says, go back. If you go back for election, we are going to vote for you. But don't tell us to fight each other. So Kenyans swore never to fight for, you know, each other because of an election of sorts. And that's something which is really important. Also, Kenyans over the time, when they experience with their democracy, they have come to understand politicians. Because what politicians are, they're like men in a game or women in a game. And you see, they will like say anything, do anything to paint their opponent in the wrong, you know, in the wrong direction or in the wrong picture. So when you look at them, oh, fine. And you see them as your enemy. You deem them to be your enemy. But Kenyans are seen behind the scenes.
President Ruto has admitted that the expectations of the people of Kenya are huge and his administration will not have the luxury of wasting time. Now, are the people of Kenya optimistic that this government will meet their expectations?
From the way they kicked off, hasn't been pleasant to everybody. They criticized the current regime now in power. They criticized the former government of making the cost of living so expensive for everybody. Of course, to the level that the former government had to subsidize price commodities for food, basically, and also in terms of fuel, also they did that. But this particular government now in power, they used to promise Kenyans, when we get into power, life will be cheaper. We are going to bring things, make things cheaper.
Well, many analysts, just like Ms. Sambaluto, have criticized the scrapping of subsidies by the new administration. However, President Ruto has elaborated on the reasons for the removal of fuel subsidies.
In addition to being very costly, consumption subsidy interventions are prone to abuse. They distort markets and create uncertainty, including artificial shortages of the very products they seek to subsidize. The cost of living challenges are related, in our respectful submission, to production. Our strategy to bring down the cost of living is predicated on empowering producers.
The congratulatory messages to Kenya's new government from leaders of other countries in Africa and globally are pointer that the world is eager to deepen engagements with President Ruto. During his inauguration speech, he highlighted some of his foreign policy priorities.
Kenya will continue, ladies and gentlemen, to be a dedicated partner to peace, security, and prosperity of East Africa region. We look forward to deepening our integration. We welcome our newest member, the DRC, whose entry now extends our region from the Indian Ocean to the Atlantic. Kenya is fully committed to the implementation of the East African Community Treaty and its protocols of free movement of people, goods, and services. Equally important is our commitment to the full actualization of the Africa Continental Free Trade Area. Ladies and gentlemen, Kenya will continue playing its role in international diplomacy at the bilateral and multilateral levels, appreciating that we are host to major international agencies, including the United Nations.
In his official address, soon after his swearing-in, Ruto said his administration will prioritize tackling unemployment through various measures. Let's take a listen.
Jobs, ladies and gentlemen, is our other priority. It is time for us to stem the tide of youth unemployment. Every year, 800,000 young people join the workforce, and over 600,000 of them do not find opportunities for productive work. Our immediate agenda is to create a favorable business and enterprise environment, decriminalize livelihoods, and support people in the informal sector to organize themselves into stable, viable, and creditworthy business entities.
Domestically, the priorities of William Ruto's administration are expected to focus on the immediate uplifting of the living standards across the country, particularly because he portrayed himself as a hustler and a champion of the poor in his campaign for the presidency. Now, our last question, will the policies announced by President Ruto alleviate the economic challenges many Kenyans are facing, especially unemployment?
Yeah, policies are key to drive any government. Formulation of policy takes a lot of consultation if it's going to have impact with the masses of the people. And I think right now what matters in Kenya, whichever way you look at it, ordinary folks, they're like, you're pricing life so much away from our reach. Number one, all food commodities have to come down. That's whether you like it or not, to make it affordable to ordinary folks. Number two, fuel prices, whatever they have to do, stop blaming Ukraine, Russia. Think about locally. What can you do so that you don't keep saying Russia, Ukraine? War is the one that's causing all this pain. No, no excuses, no scapegoats. The government has to do something, if it is to subsidize oil, to bring it low because it affects everything else. Number one, that's what ordinary folks want to see. Number three, the policies that are crafted by this regime, they have to be very focused on those people who are struggling in terms of health.
Well, our guest there says that the newly elected government of Kenya will need to focus on alleviating economic hardships facing the people in this most advanced economy in East and Central Africa. Thank you very much, Julius Mbaluto, for your time today. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. Goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The imperial hubris on display in the use of such lingo towards poor nations can't hide America's own failures, says Belen Fernandez, journalist, in an article published under the heading, Trump likening the U.S. to a third world country is